Hello?
Yes, there we go. Welcome to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series. We're so glad you could join us.
Before we get started, I just want to remind you of a couple rules. Mainly, please try to respect our reader tonight and not make loud noises or have your cell phone on. You are more than welcome to help yourself to a drink or to use the restroom, but please be respectful of our reader. And if you could be so kind as to join me in welcoming the person introducing our reader tonight, Tanya Gray.
God, I love that there's a light. I've enjoyed getting to know Aaron Hoover over my time here at FSU. Quiet, unassuming, clear-eyed honesty, a lack of patience for small talk, a shared passion for all things feminist and angry and rawr. In Aaron Hoover's debut collection, Barn Burner, the speaker renders a coming-of-age and a lyric narrative from the settings of a depressed Pennsylvania town to the hive static of New York City. In her opening epigraph, there was once a Dutchman who was so bothered by the rats in his barn that he burned it down to get rid of them. That a barn burner is one who destroys all in order to get rid of a problem. Key to the collection is the opening poem, a prose poem set in the call center cubicle, where the speaker is tethered to the telephone, fielding calls from remorseful Book of the Month subscribers, already having received their trove for a penny. No matter how well she performs her job, she is confined to a script, given limited access to the bathroom and lunch, smoking high nicotine cigarettes every 3 hours on the dot in a designated area. The poem then juxtaposes this experience against the present-day computer-simulated voice of Samantha West, calling to provide health insurance quotes, reassuring when asked, "Are you a robot?" that she is in fact, and answers, "I am a real person." It's this questioning that serves as central intelligence or omniscience, persistently suggesting a truth that when answers are not forthcoming, and remains a truth throughout the collection. The book's kindling or chronic tension is the grind, the dailiness of dead-end jobs and situations, the slow fester of recognition that the world is indifferent and lonely and unfair, the indignity when so much is expected and so little is ever given in return. Hoover douses this fractal narrative with gasoline, the book's acute tensions, the microaggressions, the small moments when the gaslight, the lies, the inhumanity seethes from the pages, from the speaker's blank stare. Her ability to pay close attention begins to feel like a clarion call of action, of what a girl can do in the face of the patriarchy and injustice. In The Valkyrie, we see this angry angel through the eyes of a girl being robbed at gunpoint. The same hapless Valkyrie hitching up my skirt each morning to ride into Port Authority, drawing against the water torture of a system that owns my sword, portions out my rations, and his. See, even the robber is snared in the same system. And no, I'm not going to reveal the close of the closing poem, but Barn Burner is a call to 911 or God or whoever is listening to burn it all down. Rout them out, that we don't have to give in. Aaron's clear and brilliant voice is the match. Her debut poetry collection, Barn Burner, was selected by Katherine Nuremberger's for Elixir's Anti-Venom Award. Her poems have appeared in the Best American Poetry and Best New Poets series, and in journals such as Prairie Schooner, Narrative, Alaska Quarterly Review, and Pleiades. Hoover has served as past editor for the Southeast Review As a volunteer for VITA, Women in Literary Arts, and as a co-founder of the literary organization Late Night Library. And she earned, most recently, a PhD from Florida State University and currently teaches in the first year writing program. Please give a warm welcome to my friend, Erin Hoover.
Hi. Okay, thank you, Tanya, for that introduction. Now I probably should read the Valkyrie. That was the last poem. I know everyone is really busy this time of year, and so I'm grateful to see you. Barn Burner just came out October 1st. It's been a really exciting month for me. It's especially exciting to read these poems here for you. Because I wrote almost all the poems in Barn Burner in Tallahassee, and so I wanted to thank the FSU community. Some of you may recognize the names in the acknowledgments page of the book, but there are others that I didn't get to mention or who have stepped up to help me since the book came out, so it's not a complete list. You're all on it, really. People sometimes ask me why the book is called Barn Burner, and I think Tanya explained that, so I won't go into that. I think people do spend some time looking for, they're like, where is the barn burner? Where is it? So I do want to take a minute more to explain the title, because I think some people aren't sure about this. It's not about a self-destructive person, and I think Tanya really got it that really well. I'm talking about a self-destructive culture. I believe that the culture we have now, the government we have now, is an extension of political strands that existed with America's founding. Burn the thing down in order to save it. There's something beautiful there, and I can see why the idea is appealing. This is a theory, but bear with me. I think that there are two logical extremes to human behavior under late capitalism, taken to its finest extensions, nihilism and barn burning. With nihilism, nothing holds meaning. By contrast, whatever concerns the barn burner at a particular moment in time must mean everything. But both options seem to bring us fascism. So, dear audience, I intend barn burner not to talk about my own life, but as a social critique. I'm gonna start by reading a poem that appears towards the end of the book, since I just talked about acknowledgments. This poem is called With Gratitude to Those Who Have Made This Book Possible. It has an epigraph from The Philadelphia Story, a movie. With the rich and mighty, always a little patience. I've got a story for you where I'm the asshole, and the other assholes in it are my friends. A story about the lives most of us will never afford, though their scuttlebutt details seduce us. Its subject is the people and the parts of the city that turn the majority of us into Victorian urchins, noses pressed against steamy bakery windows. Among these friends is my college roommate, who every summer invites me to her French chalet, routinely forgetting that in order to eat, I heave my body daily into a midtown office. She tells me I'm better than that job when I decline. But today I've been asked to a Prospect Park picnic. And when I arrive, I'm hugged earnestly, invited to sample citrus oil from someone's endless cache of gift bags. I've brought a summer salad, corn and heirloom tomatoes from the green market, I diced carefully to impress people that I'd hoped a decade ago to be like, girls whose fathers built pipelines in Africa while they wrote papers about French colonialism in school. Back then, I pretended to be them, though at night I joined the other scholarship kids to prank numbers from our school directory, roused gentle Bitsy from Potomac or dyspeptic Mortimer in Bel Air at 3 a.m. because I could. Every distant family member of mine would have to die at once to inherit me into one of my friends' second homes. Of course I felt inadequate, but we spent so much time together, it seemed I'd as easily marry a Belgian prince or a hedge fund wunderkind as they would. That first summer after college, walking in strawberry fields, my dad asked me why didn't I rent one of those little attics on Central Park West. He wasn't able to fathom the duplex penthouse behind dainty windows, or that at sleepovers at ones like it, I hesitated to spit my toothpaste in Italian marble sinks. And now my friends can't picnic in Brooklyn without someone commenting on the park's illusion of equality. Nearby, ordinary people are frying their plantains, circling the clumpy field in a game of pickup soccer. From their vantage, I am the rich person, coddled as a tiny duke or a duchess in a Renaissance court painting, or at least one of the glossy mastiffs they like to pose alongside. I only exist by proximity, but it's proximity that grants me a peek at the bespoke panic room that generates so much of what we call art and who gets to make art. The fault of these friends, I look at the acknowledgments of certain books and find I've been the plus one at birthdays for Brooklyn literati, people whose patios reminded me of the time needed to write a book, how the sting of rejection might be reduced on a golden cloud. Of course, I was dying to go. I've got a talent for noticing these friends' failures, their bakery scones staling in the sun, not an oily kernel left of my corn salad. My job is to notice. I imagine the architects who sculpted the park's hills, believing the poor deserved their share of countryside, and how growing up, I bit into tomatoes we grew ourselves. We made our own pleasures, unprofitable as the hue on a piece of fruit. Vendors pushed the day's last coconut ices as the sun sets on a lawn strewn with chicken bones, soccer balls flattened to discs. They have been kicked so hard and so often. How recently they amused somebody. Every time I read, I'm like, damn, I write long poems. So long. So I have been thinking a lot in recent years about how violence is enacted upon different groups of people. And it seems that though the victim may shift, there's a kind of violence that is constant. And so this poem I'm about to read to you, Recalibration, is about activism and trying to live a life that is ethical, which is a theme in Barn Burner. Recalibration. Sometimes one person is the gravitational center of shit going wrong. One time I was at a bodega in Brooklyn, scanning the beer cooler, when townies kicked over a tower of soup cans, cylinders of chicken rice and minestrone pelting the stock boy. Their challenge, pick it up, Habib, where are your 72 virgins now? The boy was Arab, aware as anyone else of our new, still smoldering skyline. The malt liquor bottles on the shelves lined up as precisely as a soldier's salute. And he saw the target I became when instinctually I turned toward our midnight shift of berserkers, said, do you really have to do this? In that moment, his problem became mine, the game show wheel of categorical abuses sailing past its black people and queer boys, past its recent immigrants, the needle finally landing on me, a woman, just one more kind of other. Though sometimes I escape it. Like a few months earlier when during the Republican convention, I dully circled Madison Square Garden as if it were an object I couldn't find. Then the cops told us, school teachers and civil servants, political weekenders at best, without a permit, we could only march single file. So we sang This Land Is Your Land straight up the steel cleft of Broadway for 50 well-mannered blocks until the line buckled and police nets unfurled. I heard then the lead officer point me out, cheap suit I wore for the journalists as he told his riot squad to arrest everyone but me. And another cop hissing through his helmet, sweetheart, you'll have to do something really illegal. Hard to make a point wearing the face of every white cop's daughter. And while technically not illegal, this is why I mouthed off at the creeps who decided to stalk me down the long unlit path between the bodega and home, an avenue usually flush with flower peddlers, moms with strollers, hobos in their carts. But this was Sunday night, 2 a.m., and I was considering how fast I could actually run. I was considering the next lit storefront, the safety of eyes inside when the men took a shot. Fat bitch, I'll fuck you hard enough to kill you. So I ran to the best hiding place I could reach, the alley behind the church, St. Anthony's, and crouched in the shadow of a storage box, clutching a bottle of malt liquor like a weapon, I don't know for how long, as the men, still searching, passed me by. I'll leave myself there. I'll let you imagine how I got home that night, though I'll say I kept thinking about the boy restacking his soup cans in the yellow glow of the bodega, but I never went back. I turned as if by reflex to help him, watched his darting eyes settle with relief, and we'd both seen, unmistakable, the shadow of the men's rage shifting, heard the cha-chunk as the crosshairs found my body. And I'll ask you 10 years later, what does it mean that I felt foolish? More often than I'll admit, I pass by an instance where I know I should stop, a circle of cop cars or a huddle of boys at their center, like open-air flesh in an operating theater, a figure I can hardly see, outnumbered, afraid, yet resolved to accept the punishment no one earns. And I go on past. And though I sometimes circle back, by then, of course, by then, whoever it was is gone. That's not what page this is on. Someone prepared these notes in a hurry. Okay. So the next poem I'm gonna read is called Barrier Islands. I sometimes visit Long Beach Island, which is on the coast of New Jersey. Long Beach Island really got hit by Sandy. And I was there the summer after Sandy when just like there was nobody there. There was like an open liquor store. Strangely, that was open. and I was thinking about how disaster can bring us together or rip us further apart. One divide that I think exists in our culture that is really kind of toxic is there's this idea of the communal that I think we've somehow lost. In favor of the individual. We're rugged American idealists, I guess. Okay, Barrier Islands. Now and again, you order the steak dinner for yourself at the mahogany bar in this Jersey resort town where your grandparents courted. Here and the only restaurant open among the shells of Victorian summer homes after Sandy's apocalypse, you want to know if steak dinner still means what you think it does. Sirloin and a side of potatoes. Or did the hurricane change that too? Most here wait on insurance money, the rare window lit, others gaping as skulls' eyes. It's been so long since you talked to anyone. It's as if disaster has tuned you differently into an ascetic filed sharp enough to need the soft containers of others. So one night you try talking to the couple next to you, a toned man you soon learn is a gym instructor on the mainland, his frizzy, grinning girlfriend who works for a bank. As you swipe through their phone snapshots, their concave roof, tempested balcony, they say they hate out-of-towners. Do they mean you? Your hurricane left you mostly untouched, your beach cabin roof dinged, a few feet of carpet to replace, that's all. How uneven circumstance can be, even to people close as neighbors. There's a TV show now about Amish kids, where teens from farm towns like yours try out being English, as if you're coming up boiled down to bad dance music and abundant jello shots. On the show, one kid stands in Times Square and says, "I'm a sheep in a pig pen." Now the bar declines the couple's credit card while you're off taking a piss. Returning, you find they've emptied your purse and gone. You'd left it, wanting to believe an idea you read about in school, Gemeinschaft, the community ruled by unified desire, where we depend on one another. But theirs is the horror show of individual will, Gesellschaft, each into their own. It's no use expecting more of any evening than to drink our gin, pay the check, and disappear to our cold rooms. The man had told you about his first job as a boy scooping ice cream at the parlor where decades ago you begged for a cone. The woman had offered to buy your dinner, flashing a wallet of cards she said she won in a raffle. How nice they were, good at being nice. How they seemed like friends. Okay, so I'm trying to read some of the poems tonight that I couldn't read at other readings, based on folks, sort of folks in the audience and how they might read the poems. One of these is anti-confessional, which was prompted by a poetry friend telling me that I should write about heroin, which is almost impossible to do well. I've read a lot of people write a lot of things about heroin. But this poem what I hope people pick up is that a lot of it is actually trying to thwart the expectations of the reader, because we all think we know junkies. Anti-confessional. M called me every day this week. That is this poem's most important fact. I say it first before I tell you he is a junkie. We all know not to trust what a junkie says. But I was going through some small lunacy over a man, and M was the only friend to call me on it. He said he had research. Minutes after the head detaches from the body, brain circuits still flare. So if I laid down on the tracks, I had better be ready. That's porn, though, so I'll stop. I won't describe the first time M shot up, how he made me do it for him. I'd had 5 years of allergy shots, and besides, I knew if a man wants something, I'm not the girl to say he's wrong. The best way to die, M said, is always heroin. How many dead geniuses prove it? As if we too could be geniuses. He told me that yesterday he'd run into Smalls in the parking lot at Topps Bar, told him I'm on the market. Bootleg Sage, who's kept M in mindfuck and rat poison and body bag for years, Smalls said, she'll be okay. Girls like that take care of themselves. Smart men see this, but the world's loaded with dumb men. The guy with Smalls, teeth flaying the skin from a chicken thigh, kingpin who met me once in a parking lot and cited the street value for my car's parts, said to M, next time I'm in town, I've got a free bag, just come by the bar. Evidence, M said, of my options. M and I share a past, a snag of memories locked together like hair tangled in a drain. I saw, in middle school, when a gang of boys paid a trampy girl to sit on M's lap, stroke his face, and whisper sexy. The boys pay off the revulsion she tried to squelch looking into his fat face. None of us is good at hiding that look. And he knew me in the years revulsion was my turn-on, kissing on the rusted asses of Navy Yard ships or in nursery school broom closets. Have I said enough? Tonight, M calls me from a strip mall where I waited with him dozens of times, talking Foucault or robotics, any subject besides the tangible fact of our lives, the weight inversely proportional to the quality of the eventual shit. He thinks he can save my life with phone calls, with words. I tell him, junkies are the only people worth talking to about love because junkies are the only ones who ever felt it. Like our hometown sinkhole on Front Street that sucked down parked cars, implosion we always suspected as kids riding past before it opened. A place to junk the feelings we had, the ones we didn't believe, the ones we did. Sorry, I'm just like thinking about how I'm gonna do this. So for a long time I was asked about whether I wanted children almost constantly. And I wanna read two poems now that deal with that impulse. I've done a lot of thinking about these questions. What is a good mother and what is a good woman? So the first poem, Why Don't You Have Kids? When my friend S and her son visit me to swim, she says that a few days ago, her husband hurled a mug of coffee at her. The storm that knocked out half the town's lights had blown a tree trunk down on the roof of S's car, and her husband was pissed she tweeted a picture of it before their son could climb from the back seat. The kid was safe, S says, safe. I affirm that her husband is a jerk, the worst. My house has power. My freezer churns to cool the popsicles I offer, the six-pack she's asked me to buy. Her son won't take a popsicle, pouts at anything I offer. In the pool, he laughs too often. Her husband has gone wherever men go to disappear. The boy and I race across the pool, and S watches as I dog paddle to let him win, as I fake outrage when he accuses me of not really trying. That's when she asks, "Why don't you have kids?" I know how I'm supposed to respond, like I know how to slice water cleanly with my arms and legs. I should say I don't want children, or that I want them, and put forth a short-term plan. Instead, I tell her, some people find each other in the midst of other things, the same city block, the same lunch rush at the taqueria, comparisons of the same black flag tattoo, and others don't. Like we did, S says, about the husband who called her a bad mother. Meanwhile, two new boys have joined us in the pool, their mothers smoking at its edge, and the boys soon fight with S's son because he leaps inside their circle for the action figure they toss back and forth. They call him a freak, and it's a word I've heard too. I turn to one boy, snot slug sliding down his lip, and say, "What are you throwing? Can I see it?" Then I catch his throw expertly because that's important with boys. I toss the toy to S's son, who makes a show of plunging for it. In the changing room, S is asking Facebook for an attorney to call. So it's just me and her son, and it's okay. We play in the piss-warm water. We dive toward the blur of the toy. I'm certain when doctors open my corpse, they'll find this story in all its versions. With forceps, they'll pull apart the question women are asked, press the strands of my answers onto slides. But this is the wrong way to look. As if all possible offspring existed in a woman's atmosphere, as if it were as easy as plucking her child from the air. Okay, so when a woman has a child with the help of assisted reproductive technology, the intersections of biology and commerce become extremely clear. It's a quest that bankrupts some people. So I think for a woman, choosing not to have children can be an act of resistance or rebellion, but I also think that motherhood outside of the specific conditions we expect to find it and we put on it, I think that is an act of resistance as well. On the origin of species, I'm full of opinions tonight. Something's got me all fired up. Okay, what if the pilled arms of waiting room chairs in a fertility clinic are the closest I come to natural selection? Date of my last period hard and fast as my account balance, this perpetual withdrawing of eggs. When I said I wanted this, coughed out in some exam room, I want a baby, as if by saying it, someone else would have to deal with that. The doctor asked if I'd ever thought about just having sex. As in, maybe you find a decent man and forget the condom. Maybe you say you're on the pill, and then you do everything on your own, like always. Instead, I'm on Park Avenue to see how many eggs I have left. It turns out a lot. Grayscale caviar on an ultrasound screen. But soaking in their nightly bath of wine, I should be paid not to harvest them. As if it could be entered on any chart that in another life, while everybody got lit in the other room, I'm the one who cared for the dealer's toddler, wiped up her spit, read to her from a dingy picture book as I waited for my turn at the pipe. Because the binary of women's choices is false. Striver or stroller maven. For years, I played the third option. Sad sack who creeps behind the yellow wallpaper of every can you have it all cover story, rank with garlic and gin. I'm here now for another chance, continuance. In this room, waiting with the others, all range of middles belling outward, all order of histories, I found my kind. Whatever else we are, here to claim our children. Okay, I think I'll just read two more poems. I'm going to read The Valkyrie, but then I'm going to go back and read another poem. So The Valkyrie is the last poem in the book, and I don't know, I was just reading a review of the book, and it said that the book resists narrative progression, and I was like, yeah, I did that. That was on purpose. But then the last poem does kind of attempt to resolve some things. Okay. The Valkyrie. Strapped to the wheel of perpetual awareness, I listen as my boss says, if I want to keep my job, I'd best think hard, not about the minutes I waste, but the seconds. So when a man catches the ATM door behind me, each blink I take feels like a good long sleep I've earned. I don't notice at first the worm of his mustache, butter-colored arms starred with moles, or the side pocket protrusion of his gun, until he motions at it, then me, to hand him the single crisp bill I've withdrawn to help me get hammered tonight. It's already growing soft as I wad it into his palm, relieved to comply completely, to be sure of doing it right. But then he says, take out the rest. Now, with the barrel nudging my left lung, there it is on the screen, in the certainty of ones and zeros, how little I have left. Only last night, I went home with a guy who asked me to strangle him. So I put my hands on his neck and squeezed, said, no one will even notice you're gone, in the stony voice I usually reserve for myself. The words came easily, but how loud they were in that musk-hot room, how his body tensed felt new. So I moved to snatch back the bill, and my robber's hand opens as if he expects it, the rule that anything given in the world is soon retracted. The gun there still, and me, banking on him as the kind to shove a girl down a flight of stairs, that they'll do enough work to shut her up. But there are no stairs, no hypothetical falls, just my explanation to him that today I turned off the lights in the supply closet to cry. How pieces of me remain in my office cube long after security sets the night alarm, and that some part of me is always there, two eyes under a desk, the same hapless Valkyrie hitching up my skirt each morning to ride into Port Authority, drawing against the water torture of a system that owns my sword, portions out my rations and his. His hard face breaks into pity, eyes and jaw relaxing. He puts the gun away, a teenager in dirty jeans, skin of the innocent, and says, don't tell anyone, please. My eyes close against the war drum of our twinned pulses. The wheel stops for us. It finally stops. So I have like just one more poem. So before I read this last poem, I just want to thank again everyone in attendance. Many of you have supported me for years and years. Thank you to the BARC for hosting the Jerome Stern Writer Series. Thank you, Matt and Laurel, for doing the work of turning people out for it. Some of you may already have copies of Barn Burner. I sound so pretentious saying that. I'm going to assume none of you have copies of Barn Burner. You should buy a copy from Midtown Reader if you're interested, and I'd be happy to sign them for you if you want. So thank you again. Reading Sappho's Fragments. I prefer the whole. Despite all the theory I've read, I believe in an understory nested in what we say to each other, clamoring for air beneath. I like the effort and completion. I'm always lifting the banner of a manifesto and carrying its shield like a girl saint in men's armor turning back a siege. I do this with words, knowing at best they are a surface, a roof or a cloak or hard stitching of a quilt. But at least I can know. I am this twist tie of wiry nerves sheathed in some thinning performance of skin. Every day now more people are dying from cheeseburgers and chokeholds, and I have lived through so many wars about what people won't say. This isn't Sappho's fault. Maybe I'm jealous. I've given my reader no gaps to leap across. My poems are a murder story, clear immediately that someone will kill someone else. It's convention now, after the tragic event, to say, there are no words. But I believe there are always words. There are, after all, bodies, and they deserve words, anybody's and mine. I'm not saying close those brackets in Sappho, crayon away the mystery of an unnamed love. I'm saying do not be satisfied with our long pauses. If you can't hear my heart, at least unstop your ears for my profanities. Otherwise, I find myself bloodless as meat slabbed in a freezer, and these are bloody times. Reader, let's not waste our urgent and bright desires confessing what might have been. I want the ending we've earned, not the sucker punch, but to stand with you in the path of the wallop. Thank you.
Can we get one more round of applause for our reader?
Yay!
So as Aaron said, we do have copies of Barn Burner available for purchase at this table right over here, and it sounds like she'll be happy to sign them, so be sure to take advantage of that.
Thank you, sorry. And we'd like to remind you to please bust your glasses and dishes back here by the kitchen. And actually, next week we're taking a little break, so we won't have a reading because of Thanksgiving, but please join us on November 27th when we'll hear from Tanya Gray and Coco Williams. Thank you.